from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Goldman Environmental Prize is known as the Green Nobel, one of the most prestigious awards given for environmental activism. Many winners have challenged big corporations or corrupt government officials who are harming the environment and sometimes risking prison or even death. The six winners receive $150,000 each, as well as international attention for their work. We'll talk with a few of this year's Goldman Prize winners about how they are changing the world. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. And in this opening forum hour, we meet three environmental heroes who are among the select few from different continents being honored later today in San Francisco for their grassroots environmental activism. This year's Goldman Environmental Awards. Each winner receives $150,000 and international attention, recognition, and acclaim. It's the most prestigious award. And every year I try to go and see those who are the recipients actually on the screen and meet them here in studio. And it's a thrill to have them. Let me tell you who is joining us, in fact, for this hour. Well, actually, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to introduce them one at a time, and I'm going to do that by introducing them through the videos that have been made. You'll hear the audio part and get a kind of glimpse of what they are about and the work that they did. Kim Wasserman Nieto actually grew up in Chicago, and she represents North America. Each recipient represents a continent. Chicago neighborhood of Little Village. She now runs a Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, which is a nonprofit that has helped shut down two coal power plants that were polluting her neighborhood. Let's hear a clip that describes the work she does.
Activist Kim Wasserman was born and grew up here, less than a mile from one of the plants. Her organization, El Bejo, has been fighting for environmental justice in the community for years.
Seeing so many children and so many seniors impacted by health issues, I was able to pull that anger from our community and really try to focus it into a positive energy, which was to take on the coal power plant.
A Harvard public health study linked increased emergency room visits, thousands of asthma attacks, and premature deaths to toxic emissions from the two plants.
These power plants killed over 3,000 people since they began operating in 1924.
With children being the most vulnerable, Kim began a neighborhood grassroots campaign.
And so going door to door with my child, talking to parents, talking to families, hearing their stories about what they went through and how they had to miss work because they were having to stay home with their children. Taking those stories and really building consciousness in our community was really key to this campaign.
And Kim Wasserman Nieto joins us in studio. Good morning. Congratulations on being one of the three winners who are here with us this morning and one of the winners of Goldman Environmental Award, which, as I said, is perhaps one of the most prestigious in the world.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Morning. This is a 15-year battle to shut down these plants.
Yes, it is.
And what got you started? Your son had an asthma attack?
My son had an asthma attack at 2 months old, and just going through that very scary process of not knowing what to do and, more importantly, wanting to understand why it had happened and what I had done wrong really fueled my fire to want to understand what was in my environment, what was impacting not just my child but all the children in our neighborhood.
And this is largely a Mexican-American community.
That is correct.
That we're talking about here. And there was a Harvard Health study also that corroborated. That's what we heard him referring to when he talked about the 3,000?
Correct. Correct. When we first started in 98, there wasn't a study, and it didn't come out until 2000. So we actually organized for 2 years just on our assumptions that something was wrong. And when the study came out, it was the ammunition we needed to go to the city and go to the state and show that we knew that something in our neighborhood was not right.
Well, the video clip we just heard, actually, the voice of Robert Redford features Rahm Emanuel smiling and very happy and so forth. You got to the mayor, but you got beyond the mayor, really. You got to the federal government.
We did. We did. We attacked on every front that we possibly could, on a county level, a city level, a state level, and on a national level as well.
And the status now, I mean, after all this campaigning and protest and billboards and the coalition you build, talking about maybe a park there.
Well, actually, the coal power plants shut down last year, which we're very excited about. And right now we're looking at a multi-use for the site, mixed industry, some open space.
Congratulations again. This is an inspiring story, and Kimberly Wasserman Nieto is one of the winners of the 2013 Goldman Environmental Prize. We've got, like I said, a couple of other winners with us here in studio, and let me introduce them, and let me also follow up by having you hear about them. Azam Alwash has been working to restore the Mesopotamian marshlands in southern Iraq, and the marshlands were once filled with animals and reeds, which the native Iraqis used to build homes. All that changed during the regime of Saddam Hussein during his rule. Let's hear a clip about the marshlands and Azam Alwash's work there.
During Saddam Hussein's oppressive regime, the dictator ordered that the marshes be drained and burned in order to flush out rebel forces. Because of the tyrannical government, Alwash fled Iraq for Los Angeles, where he became an engineer. In 2003, after Saddam's fall, he returned to his war-torn country and set out against overwhelming scientific and political odds to bring the marshland back to its former splendor. Azam worked with the Marsh Arabs to plan for the sustainable restoration using his engineering and technical skills.
And so, lo and behold, experts don't know diddly. Because within 6 months of introducing water, the reeds came back, the fish came with the water. Today, as we speak, 76% of the marshes that are possible to restore have been restored.
Azam is now lobbying to have the marshlands declared a national park so that their future will be secure.
Never say it can't be done. They said that, like 10 years ago, it can't be done. Dream and dream big. It's free, first of all, but it's possible.
Azam Alwash, again here with us in studio, winner of the 2013 Goldman Environmental Prize. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
And we're talking about actually what some people believe is the original Garden of Eden. It was a place that was very close to your heart. I mean, you were living in Los Angeles, but this was a place you grew up in.
Indeed. I have very, very warm memories of these wetlands, this incredible water world in the middle of this barren desert that is southern Iraq. My father was an irrigation engineer and in a farming.
So he knew more than diddly.
You know, he is the irrigation engineer in a farming community. As such, he was a very, very busy man. And my memories of the marshes are the few moments that I had him all for myself, meandering in small boats in these small little streams with reeds towering above you. And fish in the water, and most importantly, my dad's full attention.
So, a magical childhood haven, I think, would be a way to describe it. And also 6,000 square miles. This is one of the largest, marshes of its kind. Of
indeed,
kind.
It is the largest wetland in the Southwest Asia. It is an important migratory bird station. But more importantly for us, it is what is considered to be the cradle of Western civilization. You see, along the edges of these marshes, agriculture was invented. Writing was invented. Abraham was born. In a sense, these marshes don't belong to Iraq. In a sense, they belong to all the world.
And 76% have been restored, which is really quite extraordinary, and in great part thanks to you. And again, congratulations on the work that you've done. There's also a whole way of life, especially for so many farmers, that was destroyed, yes?
Indeed. These people that live in the middle of the marshes are inheritors of our connection to the Sumerian world that pre-existed. Of course, I did not know that at the time I was growing up in Iraq. You have to understand that we look down upon these people. You know, they're hicks. They're backwards people. I mean, we didn't call them wetlands, by the way. We called them swamps. and so the connection did not become clear to me until I came out to the West and start reading about the history of civilization. And back in my memory comes these visions of the way these people lived. And it's like, oh, my goodness.
So I think the way you put it is we've given back our soul.
Indeed.
We've got our soul back. Yeah. Azam Alwash, again, a winner of the 2013 Goldman Environmental Prize. He returned to his native Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein and has been working to restore the Mesopotamian marshlands. Another winner who is here with us, joining us for this segment of Forum, is Jonathan Lead and Jonathan Deal. Excuse me. I think I switched the. I didn't. What they call a flip of your name there. I'm sorry about that. But Jonathan Deal actually spearheaded and continues to spearhead the anti-fracking movement in the Karoo, which is a water-scarce region in South Africa. And he says fracking causes a lot of damage to the land, the animals, and farmers who live there. Let's hear a clip.
When Jonathan Deal heard that Shell Oil had targeted the Karoo as the perfect location for shale gas extraction, he took a hard look at what it would cost the region and its people.
Very special places like this in Africa are very much under threat.
Before the fracking controversy emerged, he had no previous grassroots experience, but he wholeheartedly took on the role of spokesman for the anti-fracking movement in South Africa.
There is an upward flow of water in the Karoo. It can be.
He vehemently challenged Shell's plan through a media and social networking campaign, public debates and lectures, and ultimately through legal action against Shell. Jonathan's ever-expanding constituency of some 100,000 participants includes farmers whose families have been working this land for generations.
Water's a great issue for farming here in the Karoo. Without it, we can't raise sheep or vegetables, and our whole operation will go under. That's why we've all stopped buying any Shell Oil products in protest.
In 2011, after months of personal and financial sacrifice, Jonathan's pressure on the South African government resulted in a nationwide moratorium on all shale gas exploration. Having kept fracking out of South Africa for 2 years, the fight will most certainly lead to a legal battle in the highest court in the country.
And again, Jonathan Deal, a winner of the 2013 Goldman Environmental Prize, who founded the Treasure Karoo Action Group, which fights against fracking by Shell and other oil companies in the Karoo, which is, a water-scarce region in South Africa. Thank you and congratulations. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Well, where do things stand now?
I think that the last couple of days, particularly in the U.S. with all the attention on fracking and being here with the Goldman Prize, has given me the opportunity to reflect on what this journey has been. And in the 2.5 years of our campaign, I started off in a very extreme position saying no fracking, never, ever, under any circumstances. And then one realized that there was a sort of controversy and that there was an alternative scientific view. And so it became one where, okay, possibly we could consider it with the right regulation and under the right conditions. And in the last quarter of this present phase of our campaign, I find myself back at the same place I was right at the beginning, except this time I have the scientific information and the background, and my position is that in any country in the world, there is just no justification, moral, social, legal, political, economic, for something like fracking to go ahead. We're bankrupt as an environment, and the oil and gas industry is offering us another credit card from the same bank.
Well, fracking is one of those topics that really gets people fired up, especially environmental-minded people, although there are many who say, well, we need the oil. We have to get the oil somehow. And you say what to that?
I say that we have to change our lifestyles, and it's got to start with the affluent and the privileged people around the world who consume much, much more than many families that are not affluent and not privileged, and we need to start making that change at our levels. But it's absolutely abundantly clear that we don't need another fossil fuel. The chase to shale gas is delaying the onset of renewables, and it's locking developed and developing nations into a dependence on fossil fuels.
Well, can you maybe describe the savannah land when you were growing up? And I should mention Jonathan's a photographer, actually a well-known photographer in his native South Africa, but, you know, as opposed to what it looks like now.
It's a very arid and water-scarce region. We are the only arid hotspot in the world, an acknowledged world-renowned hotspot for biodiversity, and very similar to what one might encounter in Wyoming. And at this stage, it is still literally pristine because there's been no fracking that's taken place. But what we want to avoid is a situation like they're dealing with in Wyoming, where after 8 or 10 years of gas drilling, the air pollution has been measured as higher than the center of Los Angeles.
And the effect on game, farming, I mean, has been profound.
Well, it could be enormous were it to go ahead. And that's one of the great problems that the economists have, because they value things. They simply extrapolate the jobs and the benefits that is put out by the oil and gas industry. They're not valuing the natural capital. And if you look at a recent book by an author called Tony Juniper, who happens to be the advisor to Prince Charles, he's an environmental writer, and they say quite clearly that the value of the environment to the world is twice the gross national product in any country, in any region. And that's where it's at. We can't destroy the system that keeps the earth going.
Yeah, Prince Charles has been kind of a royal spokesman against fracking now. And again, Jonathan Deal, winner of the 2013 Goldman Environmental Prize, congratulations. I'm going to open up the phone lines and give you, our listeners, an opportunity to talk to this trio of Green Nobel recipients, which, again, is certainly one of the most prestigious awards given to environmental activists. And many stories are really quite inspiring, and they're extraordinary stories. And I wonder what kind of effect they have on you when you hear them. And you certainly have an opportunity to ask questions also of our guests. Let me tell you how you can join us. You can join us now at our toll-free number, which is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. And particularly would like to hear from how these stories affect you and what they do in terms of your own consciousness, or your heart for that matter, when you hear these stories. You don't have to necessarily be an environmentalist to weigh in here. In fact, we just like to hear from you. And, of course, questions are welcome as well. 866-733-6786. And there are a number of other ways to communicate with us, your thoughts and feelings. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can post any questions or comments you might have immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Many of these winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize have really put themselves at risk, have challenged big corporations or corrupt government officials who are harming environments. Every year I've gone, this year I'm not going to be able to, and every year we've featured some of these recipients with us. And there's not only a lot of hard work and labor that goes into what they've done, but there's also an immense amount of, in so many instances, courage that they show and sacrifice. And I think an opportunity for you to speak with the three award winners we have with us. Jonathan Deal, again, founded the Treasure Karoo Action Group, TKAG, which fights against fracking by Shell and other oil companies in the Karoo, which is a water-scarce region in South Africa. Azam Alwash returned to his native Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein and has been working to restore the Mesopotamian marshlands in southern Iraq, which have been called the original site, by the way, of the Garden of Eden, and he's since restored marshes over half their original size. And Kimberly Wasserman Nieto, who is Executive Director of Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, a nonprofit in Chicago which works to improve the environment of Little Village, Mexican-American by large Mexican-American community, and also surrounding Chicago. One of its campaigns actually focuses on getting rid of the toxic chemicals from the nearby coal and power plants, and that is what we've been talking about here. Let me, before I do anything else, go to your calls here. And Maura, let's begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Great. I first want to thank you so much for being on the air and talking about all of these environmental issues that are so important to us today. I'm calling from San Francisco, and I've been very inspired by these stories because right now we're running a grassroots campaign in the city to save Golden Gate Park from a 7-acre astroturf artificial soccer field. And not only would this take Golden Gate Park off of the National Registry of Historic Places, but it would also affect the Snowy Plover Preserve and multiple other wildlife refuges in Golden Gate Park, which is a great asset to our city. So I'm wondering if your guests have any information or knowledge that they could share with me about how to make this project take off, how to garner more support before the Coastal Commission makes their final decision on whether or not to let this development project go through.
Well, let me ask the environmental activists, from your experience, if there's any advice or wisdom, just generally, those who are working on a local level to try to change things. And particularly, I think Kimberly Wasserman-Yetta will defer to you here initially.
I think the reality is just really having community members find that connection to why this is important to them and how, you know, the ecology of the Golden Gate Park, what that means to them, because they may not know. I think for a lot of our community members, you know, the economy, education, jobs are all things that are priority over the environment. So making that link for them on how the environment plays into those things, but also research. I think the reality is whenever you have an opponent, you have to arm yourself with the research that they're using and understand what it is that's helping them make that decision and collect your own research and really provide that to them so that they can make a just and sound decision in the work that they're doing.
Well, you had those public health environmental statistics behind you, of course. Then there was some blowback on that. There was a commission study under Midwest General Spokesman who said 99% of the particulate matter in Cook County comes from other sources. And so there was some contention in terms of the statistics, the numbers, as there always is.
As there always is, as there always is, yes.
But what you're suggesting is make it something that they have a stake in.
Most definitely. I think people are always looking for something that connects to them and always looking to share their story. So allowing people to share their story and find the connection to that issue will lead them to fight for it even with more resilience and more fight.
And I imagine, Azam and Jonathan, you would agree with the wisdom of that, Azam?
My experience has not been in organizing in the United States, so I rightfully defer to Kimberly. But something that has puzzled me in the past 10 years of activism is, why does not nature have a standing in court?
It's an excellent question.
You know, the media thing that ran into my mind, has anybody studied the runoff from artificial coverings? And, of course, that would affect fish in the bay. But who's going to sue on behalf of fish? Nature does not have standing. And we have a big hole in the laws in the United States and worldwide. Nature must gain at least similar rights to corporations.
Well, it doesn't have a voting constituency. That's part of the problem. But also, there are those that work in the environmental movement who try to present lobbying force and try to raise funds because essentially this is a government. I can't necessarily say the same for South Africa, and certainly Iraq may be closer to this, but it's a government where, you know, you skid the wheels and you get things done that way through money.
I mean, I think it's going to be evolution. Just like corporations gain the same speech rights as you and I think eventually we'll get nature the same rights, but we need intrepid lawyers to explore that area of the law and expand it.
Well, Jonathan Deal, I mean, you're going up against an extraordinary amount of money when you take on Shell Oil. I mean, their revenue is almost limitless, it seems.
Yeah, and their propensity to bend the truth, but that's a conversation for another time. But my advice to the lady that's dealing with the AstroTurf challenge is certainly you need to get media on your side and also accept the fact that there are people that would like the AstroTurf to go ahead for their own reasons, and one needs to be able to work in the community to find them some sort of alternative as well. It can't just be taken away. So one has to try and find a way to accommodate all of the players in that mix of that problem.
Thank you for that, and we will continue this conversation. We'll continue taking your calls and emails, and again, feel free to join us talking with three of the Goldman Environmental Prize winners. Green Nobel Prize, certainly one of the most prestigious awards given for environmental activism in the world. And when we return, you'll be involved. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This evening in San Francisco, the annual Goldman Environmental Prizes will be awarded to this year's recipients. There's one from each continent. It's known as the Green Nobel, and the award, three of the award winners are here with us in studio this morning. Jonathan Deal, a South African photographer who found that he was quite concerned about fracking in the arid and water-scarce Karoo region and got the government to actually issue a moratorium to oil executives. Azam Awash, an Iraqi expatriate who returned from California, where he was living, to restore Mesopotamian marshlands, thought once to be the original Garden of Eden, and were drained and poisoned and set ablaze by Saddam Hussein. And Kimberly Wasserman Nieto, 15-year battle she led to shut down two of the oldest and dirtiest coal plants on the southwest side of Chicago. She's the leader of Little Village in the Mexican-American community. Let me go right to more of your phone calls here, and let me go to Occidental. Eric, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to note that probably 30 or 35 years ago, former Justice of the Supreme Court William O. Douglas authored a book called Do Trees Have Standing, where in the context of the U.S. legal system, he discussed the issue of nature and law and standing to litigate.
There you go.
And?
Justice Douglas, yeah. And he's waiting with bated breath for you to finish the statement, Eric.
Well, it's a treatise on the subject in the United States, so it may not apply, obviously, in other legal systems, but it is a subject that has been explored with some thoroughness in the U.S. And I also hear, since organizations have standing, for example, the Sierra Club, on behalf of nature, if you will, is able to litigate to enforce environmental laws and so forth. So it's not an arena that is completely devoid of representation for nature, as you characterize it.
I guess the question is there any legal precedent, though? I'm not aware. Are you, Eric, aware of a specific legal precedent came from either Justice Douglas or from law as it was decided through jurisprudence?
Not in the pure form that I think your guest was suggesting.
Yeah, I think that's
so,
right.
So we need to have that area of the law evolve a little bit more until we get the ability to sue on behalf of nature, then we will have to depend on some party like Kimberly or the community. And I really look forward to some intrepid lawyer taking on that mantle and expanding that area of the law.
That's a fascinating notion, and we have all kinds of lawyers who listen to this program, so get off your duffs. Actually, here's a listener who writes in an email, Azam Awash sounds like an excellent candidate for a Ramsar site. The Ramsar Convention is an intergovernmental treaty that provides the framework for national action and international cooperation for the conservation and wise use of wetlands and their resources.
And Huwaiza Marsh, okay, so the marshes of southern Iraq are divided generally into three marshes, one easterly of the Tigris River, shared between Iraq and Iran, and that was declared in 2005 a Ramsar site. Unfortunately, Iran set about building an embankment along the border for security reasons or oil reasons, we don't know. It cut off essentially the flow of the Karkha River, which is one of the four rivers that fed the marshes. And as a result, the Huwaiza Marsh shrank by about 50%. And hence, since then, Iraq has put Huwaiza Ramsar site, on the Montreux list, which is basically the list a list that indicates those wetlands that are in danger and that are in need of address by member nations to this treaty. The Ramsar Convention, however, is a contracting party. It's not an obligation, an international obligation. So it does not provide the protection that we would need. What we're working right now is creating a national park, the first national park in Iraq and the Central Marshes, and we hope that that will put at least the Iraqi government on a legal obligation to maintain these marshes for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren to enjoy.
Well, speaking about children and grandchildren to enjoy and future generations, Jonathan Deal, I know that Shell Oil said they're going to leave everything even better than they found it, which is really, I suppose, impossible.
Yeah, certainly, Michael, it was one of the comments that really, really flew in the face of common logic. And the environmental devastation that would follow something like fracking in South Africa would just be completely ridiculous to even think about. They have a history, the oil and gas industry, of coming into pristine areas, positioning themselves as philanthropists and community-focused organizations, making mistakes, polluting, really denying the pollution, and if they're actually caught out and taken to terms in court, using enormous resources to stonewall the thing.
Well, you took them to court. You got a two-year moratorium out of it.
We did. The moratorium was really imposed against the entire technology in South Africa, but one of the things that we enjoyed in South Africa was taking them to our Advertising Standards Authority, and we succeeded in getting four judgments against them for false and misleading advertising. And that, I believe, is the where the strength in this fight lies globally. I'd like to leave the United States with the beginnings of a global coalition against fracking, and that's really where I'm headed.
I think you got a lot of support from some of our listeners. Let me go to more calls. We got a caller from up in Oregon. Yasha, good morning.
Good morning. My question was mostly directed to your guest from South Africa. I was wondering how and why he was able to be so successful in South Africa, what strategies he used, and can those strategies be adapted to use in America where we are so unsuccessful? And if he had any insights into why the American protest against fracking is so unsuccessful. And thank you.
Thank you. Jonathan Deal.
Yeah, thank you for the question. We were very successful at the beginning because we were able to point across the Atlantic at America and say to our government, are you mad? Can you see what's happening there? There are millions of people that are prepared to forego the benefits, the so-called benefits of fracking in places where they get their drinking water, grow their vegetables, raise their children, and generally live. And so that worked for us very well. I think that when we succeeded with the moratorium, a lot of American environmentalists were able to point across the sea to South Africa and say to their government, look at this, even in a so-called developing country, they have had the good sense to put a moratorium on it. But probably one of the biggest things that worked for us was the media. I have a mentor in the name of a man, Lewis Pugh. Some of you will remember him as the Arctic explorer that went swimming for a minute in the deep, cold Arctic waters right at the North Pole to prove that the glaciers were melting. And Lewis said to me, Jonathan, if you don't get hold of the media in this debate, you're going to be dead in the water. So media is a big issue, and you need to work with them.
Let me thank the caller. And you're going to add something, Azam Alwash?
Michael, just to follow up on the issue of law, fracking is poisoning the groundwater. We all know that. And unfortunately, I think in 10 years, we're all going to be tagged as taxpayers with cleanup. If nature has standing, then one could set it right now that the oil companies that are making the profit out of fracking will be actually responsible for the cleanup when that happens. Maybe we'll have a different dynamics if that happens.
Faiza, let's bring you on. Good morning.
Hi, I'm a big fan, and so thank you for taking my call, and great show. I want to congratulate all the winners, and thank you for all the work that you're doing. So my question is that I really want to get involved in environmental movement, but I work 50 to 60 hours a week, and there's no time, you know, to really look into what opportunities are there. So I really want to ask the guests as to how they got started. And were there any role models or any previous campaigns that they were part of that they learned the lessons from before they began the movement that they're a part of now? And I will take my question off the air.
All right, and thank you for the question. Kimberly, can we begin with you?
Sure. I definitely understand as a working mom of three, there really is never enough time. But I think anything from being active online to calling in to shows like this to showing your support in petitions and attending events on the weekends, those are all things that are very, very positive. And for me as a young woman growing up, definitely looking at the Chicano movement that came out of Los Angeles, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, and really understanding and embracing where my community came from and the struggles we went through has helped me define where I'm going as a woman into the future. So definitely encompassing the culture the community organizing that we've been a part of in our community.
These things take great time, though. I mean, they've taken great time out of your lives. Certainly your passion has been a great fuel and motivator. But Azam, you want to address the question from your perspective?
I don't know what to tell the caller. 60 hours a week is a lot of work, and you are exhausted. I'm exhausted just by listening to 60 hours.
About these flights back and forth between Iraq and Los Angeles. Yeah.
I'll tell you my personal experience, and maybe you can draw some lessons out of that. I'm an immigrant. In certain ways, I represent the American success stories. I got my PhD, got a very good job, financial success, the house, the two girls, the picket fence, and all of that. And at the end of that trip, and it's all great, the American success story, the American dream is good. But at the end of that trip, I felt empty still. And I think you said it, Michael. It's passion. One of the hardest decisions I made in my life in 2003 was to let go of a partnership in a successful engineering firm and to put the future of my children at stake. Fortunately, my wife was a breadwinner, and she took on the mantle of leading the family and giving the girls a good education while I was out there selfishly pursuing my passion.
Selfishly, or maybe for the benefit of the environment and nature.
Selfishly, I insist, it's selfish. It's self-motivation. This selfless thing that you like to describe us as, and to me at least, is not real. To me, it's selfish pursuit of my own passion. And the people that paid for this passion is not me. I'm living a great life. I'm fantastic. I'm living a dream. It is my children that have paid for this. It is my wife that have paid for this.
You couldn't, I owe them thanks. Say to yourself, I am involved in this for a higher cause, and I'm religiously devoted to this.
This is the elephant. The rider justifying the elephant. These are excuses and justifications and rationalizations. Let's be real. It's about what motivates us. It's selfishness. It's basically about us. I refuse to accept that this selfless trademark. Maybe in 10 years. But for now, I
admire your candor. There are many people who would think that your dedication speaks for itself. But you want to add your voice to this, Jonathan Deal?
I'd love to. Getting involved in the environmental movement, even if you're working 60 hours a week, the environment is so broad and there's so many issues. So pick an issue, focus on it, get to know about it, and start speaking to people about it. You'll soon get recognized as having an opinion on it. And put together opportunities for your community, for groups in your community to hear from environmentalists that do have experience. Contact the environmentalists and come and invite them to speak in your location, and use the viral media. Use the radio networks, use Twitter, use Facebook, and get it out there. Publicizing the issue and sticking to it is your biggest weapon.
And we go to more of your calls, and let's bring in a caller named Bob. Bob, you're on.
Yeah, I just was wondering if the environmentalists know that Epicenter in the Bay Area features Marin County, where they have an entire national park that they created, and that's how they dealt with protecting the environment there, and where starter homes for a fixer-upper starts at $1 million. And I'm focusing this to the representative from Iraq that wants to create a park in that wetlands that used to be home and livelihood to a great deal of the population. And this is the kind of population that needs to be protected, needs to have their livelihoods maintained. It's the political lower and middle class, which is the foundation. And in Marin County, you don't have that. I mean, basically, you're either rich or not. And that's the focus which he's going towards after returning the wetlands from a state where a madman ran it to where it should be, and now wants to go what he thinks is higher, and what environmentalists want to focus on is a higher plane, which is, you know, admirable goal, but which maybe he wants to think twice about. That's my comment.
All right. Thank you. Azam Al-Wash.
As long as there are marsh Arabs who are dependent on the marshes for their livelihood, the marshes will exist. I don't care what law the central government will pass in Baghdad. In Iraq, what matters is the locals and how involved they are. I agree completely that these marshes are not being... Well, first of all, I didn't restore the marshes. It's the Marsh Arab that restored the marshes. I helped in technical terms. I helped in advising. I helped in lobbying. I helped in organization, all that. But the main actors in the restoration were, in fact, the Marsh Arabs themselves. And what I am heartened by is the fact. Well, okay, let's go back to 2003. In 2003, we were told that the Marsh Arabs have lost the skills needed to live in the marshes. They don't want to come back to the marshes. They become farmers. It's very difficult. The seed bank is old, and it's not going to come back. And when I went back to Iraq in June 2003, almost 10 years ago, turns out that the Marsh Arabs had already breached dikes and were allowing the water to come in haphazard manner. And restoration has already been afoot. The point, however, is that these Marsh Arabs did not restore the marshes for nature. They're not bird. Well, actually, they love birds, but they love eating birds. They want the reeds to grow not because they are interested in greenery and scenery, but rather to harvest the reeds to feed their water buffalo, to build their houses, to power their ovens. And in other words, restoration in Iraq is sustainable development defined. And as long as there are Marsh Arabs who need the marshes to survive and make a living, the marshes are well and good.
Let me thank the caller and move on to an email here. I'm getting a lot of response to this idea about nature, and I knew some listeners would come through here. Here's Trish, who writes, there is an international movement to give legal rights to Mother Nature. Ecuador and Bolivia have written mm-hmm. rights for Mother Nature into their constitutions. Okay. Fracking and other assaults on our natural systems cannot be stopped until nature had its legal rights. Much more work needs to be done on this important issue. And this is from Kim in Santa Rosa, who writes, very grateful to your guests and all the Goldman recipients for their dedication to environmental causes. Question for Kim, sounds like you started at a grassroots level and stayed with it for an incredible 15 years. What tools helped you stick with it? And can you recommend specific resources for organizing?
Of course. Definitely the community, keeping them involved. I think the reality is that, you know, one has to find the willpower to maintain for 15 years. And just knowing that constantly talking to our community, constantly checking in, and constantly knowing that they were driving this fight is really what kept me motivated, but also really reaching out to other folks across the nation and across the world fighting coal power plants. I think the age of internet has allowed us the opportunity to really get to know other people and find out how their struggle is going, any tips they have, any action ideas that they might have for us, things that they have gone through, best practices that they have gone through that we can borrow from. And so I think just really reaching out to other organizations and other communities in similar battles as yours to get that support and get that know-how is very, very much a part of maintaining this fight for 15 years. But also every time that we failed, every time we fell, picking ourselves back up and really not just saying, oh, well, you know, we can't continue, but really trying to learn the lessons learned from that failure and helping us to move forward and being realistic that this is, it's not an easy fight. I wish I could say that things happen in a year, but there's no guarantee. It all really just depends on the state of the world out there. And just knowing that somebody out there is counting on you, I think, is the most important
thing. But yeah, a lot of it, as you're kind of intimating, is just overcoming the frustrations and the obstacles and the defeats and realizing that it's maybe going to sometimes be a long battle.
Exactly.
And a question for you, Jonathan Deal, could you please share where online might I find objective original research and resources for the impact of fracking?
Gosh, I wouldn't like to presume to tell you where to start. There is an enormous amount. You could certainly go to our website, which clearly is www.treasurethekaroo.co.za.
And Karoo is K-R-O-O.
That's it. Thank you. And we have worked hard to keep that information objective and factual. And it's a hallmark of our campaign over the last 2.5 years that the oil companies and their proponents have not been able to catch us out manipulating data.
And we go on to more of your calls. Jane, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to ask your fracking guest, which I'm very, very interested in, where did you get the water to do the fracking? I'd like to comment on, it's a matter of educating the public. In this country where it's of the people, by the people, and for the people, until the people understand where this water is coming from, that it's a finite commodity that we have on our planet. And as I understand it, that water that's used for the fracking cannot be reused. And if the gentleman would educate us listeners, I'd appreciate that. The whole situation is might over right, and might knows what's right, but might doesn't really care because there's money in it. And that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you, Jonathan Deal.
I love that statement, might doesn't care, and make sure that I use it. But certainly we don't have any fracking happening in South Africa at the moment, and we would like to keep it that way. But the water use is very extreme. By all accounts, in 2025, South Africa will be unable to supply its own domestic water needs for simple drinking and bathing. But that doesn't appear to bother the industry. There are three issues.
In fact, they're going to privatize water next. I mean,
yeah,
it'll be like
yeah.
Shell oil, but Shell water or whatever.
Absolutely. There are three issues with water. One is where will they find it? Secondly, how can they drill into the ground past the aquifers without the risk of polluting them? And thirdly, where do they dispose of their toxic water? And they're full of answers about how well they can recycle and how safely they can dispose of it. But it's interesting for your listeners in the United States to know that the state of Pennsylvania, even with all the drilling that's going on, doesn't allow the disposal or treatment of any fracking waste in its borders at all. All of it gets transported across the border to Ohio, where it's injected into old, disused oil wells, which is causing its own problems. So the industry has a big issue with water. They can't answer those questions.
And again, Jonathan Deal founded the Treasure Karoo Action Group, which fights against fracking by Shell. And let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Jeff next. Jeff, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I was interested in going back to sort of the topic of representing nature as sort of a defendable entity in court. I guess when you said that, that was interesting because I've sort of always thought of environmental activism in terms of like nature as a conduit, where if you were to cut down a bunch of trees, you might kill a bunch of animals, and that would have an effect on the ecosystem, and ultimately it comes back and has a negative effect on like humanity. So I was wondering, how do you what do you define nature as in terms of like objectivity, or do you define it in terms of like positive and negative effects on humanity and courts, or what did you kind of mean there? I was curious if you could expand on that.
Have you pondered this, Osama Awash, where you go with this idea of defending nature or nature being defensible?
Okay, I mean, I'll talk about the marshes. The concept came in from the marshes. Can the marshes sue internationally for their share of water of the Tigris and Euphrates? That is the inception of the whole idea in my head for over the past 4 or 5 years. And turns out there's no standing that I can use. It could be an ecosystem based. The marshes as an entity can be recognized as a national park that is an ecosystem, and that can get the rights of a corporation. I mean, that it could be as simple as that. Yosemite is a national park. Can it get the same right as Pepsi-Cola? Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah. Well, you've got corporations as individuals under the law, so at least in the American law.
Can that be a start? I don't know where that leads. I'm not a lawyer. I just see the logic of it, and I just had a hard time digesting the idea that a corporation has the same or maybe even more speech rights than an average American.
I'm really glad that you raised it. I think I'm delighted that you raised it. And let me raise some more callers here. Rebecca, thank you for waiting. You're on with us. Hi.
Thanks so much for all the work you guys are doing. It's for all of us. You know, the environment is our home. The earth is our home. It's our future. There's all kinds of is, like flautist, cyclist, racist, rapist, but there's, you know, the environment, it's not about an ism or an ist. And I think we should say that environmentalists are the real conservatives because the value of the environment is immeasurable. So thank you. Keep working, whatever the motivation.
Thank you for that call.
Thank you.
She said, whatever the motivation. let me get some responses from Jonathan and Kimberly on this notion that you know, it's a passion that drives you as opposed to perhaps wanting to dedicate yourself to a higher cause. Or I think I'm not misinterpreting what you said here, Azam. How does that resonate to you, Jonathan Deal?
I think that it's actually very interesting because we all have egos, and you see yourself on television, hear yourself on the radio, see yourself in print. And I ask myself on many occasions, Jonathan, is this about you and about your publicity, or is it about what you need to achieve? And every time I've been able to answer honestly that if somebody were to come to me and say, Jonathan, you can step aside, I can do your job the same as you or better than you, I would hand it over tomorrow and work in the background. So I'm happy that I'm not chasing the publicity. It's also been very difficult for the oil and gas industry in South Africa, because they like to present you as looking after your own interests. And my land is not near any place that is going to be fracked. I've been spending my own retirement funds to fund this campaign. I don't earn a salary. And I'm 54 years old, and I'm focused exclusively on the future generations of South Africa and Africa. And so I'm able to look in the mirror and say, I'm not doing this for a personal benefit. And that helps me a lot.
And certainly in your case, Kimberly Wasserman Nieto, I mean, as we said initially, you got in this because of your son.
Definitely. And I definitely agree with both Jonathan and Assam on the fact that I think it's both, you know, we constantly have to be asking ourselves, you know, are we doing this for our work, or are we doing this for the glory? And I think all of us going into organizing definitely don't do it because it's such a great paying job and has such a great retirement package. I think the reality is that we do this because it feeds a need in our soul to do the right thing. But I think, as was mentioned, you know, there is a sacrifice with it. You know, I've missed children's birthdays. I've missed dates with my husband. You know, I think our families do definitely pay the price, but I think the bigger price they pay is us not doing this work and having to live next to coal power plants.
Yeah. Well, your stories are inspiring, and you've certainly merited the awards. Congratulations. You will all be honored this evening. We've had with three of this year's Goldman Environmental Prize winners, Kimberly Wasserman Nieto, Azam Awash, and Jonathan Deal. Thank you again for being with us on Forum this morning.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And we're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Gucci. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.